to a Hope 103.2 podcast.
I'd like to read to you from the front page of the Evening News of India, Tuesday, October 12, some years ago. This was a day that changed my life. All 89 passengers and 6 crew members were killed when an Indian Airlines plane bound for Madras crashed within minutes of takeoff at Santa Cruz Airport at 1:40 a.m. today. The plane was only some 3 minutes airborne when its pilot noticed a fire in one of the engines. He was reported to have told air traffic control of the fire and said, "I'm coming back." Eyewitnesses, including friends and relatives who had come to see the passengers off, saw the plane burning in the night sky like a red ball before it crashed. The passengers had no chance. I remember that night very well. I was watching TV with my 2 brothers, Rob and Jamie, and the phone rang. Mum answered, and it was the news she'd been dreading ever since she heard the midday radio bulletin. "Mrs. Dixon," said the nervous voice at the other end, "I'm afraid I have terrible news. Our dad was on that plane." The days following are a bit of a blur in my memory. I was only 9 years old or something. But my mum recently told me that I approached her a day or so after the accident to ask, why did God let Dad's plane crash? Now, Mum can't recall anything of what she said in reply. Ours, like so many modern Australian homes, was not a religious one by any stretch of the imagination. We never went to church, never attended Sunday school, and so far as I can remember, we never even discussed spiritual issues. I came from a stable, loving home, but one completely without God. But somehow, as a 9-year-old boy, I still held the conviction that the Creator was meant to be responsible for keeping the world together. And on this occasion, he'd mucked things right up. This is a feeling shared every day by thousands and thousands of people, some of whom experience a level of pain and tragedy most of us will never know. Every time a marriage is betrayed, a business collapses, or a child dies of cancer. Every time a country is bombed, or a flood rages, or a famine decimates, the cry goes up, why? Why? Now, there's no point denying the force of this question. In fact, despite the confidence I may seem to exude in this series of talks on the question of suffering, I want to confess to you up front that my own faith is not untroubled by this question. I deeply feel the weight of the problem that suffering presents, and at times I still find myself asking, why God? Now, I'm not sure the Bible answers all of my questions, let alone yours. It'll soon become apparent that my own view is not that the Bible presents a complete and final explanation for all evil and suffering, far from it. But I do think that it offers the best explanation, the least incoherent one. I cling to the Bible's perspective on suffering not because it has some knockdown argument to offer, but simply because to me it appears to be the only perspective which is not itself knocked out by the force of this age-old question. It seems to be the last one standing. And that's why part of this series will explore the approach to suffering found in different religions. Now, my intention here is not to criticize the other points of view. By comparing and contrasting the alternatives, what I'm trying to do is show how unique and beautiful is the biblical perspective on suffering. But before I can explain how the other traditions understand suffering, something I'm going to try and do tomorrow night, I want to say something about how the issue of suffering and evil is sometimes used as a kind of logical proof against the existence of God. I'm sure you've heard the argument before. A friend of mine is a Qantas pilot, and one evening as he looked out of the flight deck window at the thousands of bright stars in the night sky, he said to his first officer, "Look at that, it's hard to believe there's no God." The first officer quickly replied, "Not when you've been through Vietnam and seen the violence I've seen." My Christian mate quickly changed subjects. Some people argue that the presence of evil in the world can't be reconciled with the existence of an all-loving, all-powerful God. The reasoning goes like this. If God is all-powerful, he'd be able to end suffering, and if he's all-loving, he'd be willing to end all suffering. The fact that suffering continues in the world is proof, so it is thought by some, that an all-powerful, all-loving God doesn't exist. I remember when the tsunami hit a year or so ago, the Sydney Morning Herald ran several articles arguing exactly along these lines. Now, some Christians attempt to get around this riddle by saying that perhaps God is all-loving, yeah, but maybe he's not all-powerful. They say that God, whether by inability or choice, can't raise the world above the mess it's in, that he is somehow himself caught up in the trap, just like the rest of us, that he's on a journey through the pain. This certainly solves the intellectual problem, since when people ask, why doesn't God end all the pain, this view replies, because he can't. He's enveloped in the pain just like us. Now, there is a half-truth here. One of the extraordinary things about the biblical portrait of God is that he does experience the pain of the world, and I'll talk more about that later in the series. But the problem with this way of thinking, and it's actually called process theology in academia, is that it sidesteps a fundamental declaration of the Bible. As the creator of everything, God does govern all things. He is, in fact, almighty. He's not at all limited in his power over the world. So you see, for anyone who adopts a vaguely biblical approach to the question, and I certainly want to try and do that, the dilemma remains. So does the existence of suffering disprove the existence of an all-powerful, all-loving God? Well, let me put the atheist argument in a kind of three-step philosophical equation. All right, here we go. One, an all-powerful God could end suffering. Two, an all-loving God would end suffering. Three, since suffering exists, an all-powerful, all-loving God must not exist. The argument has popular appeal and has come to have the ring of truth about it, but in terms of sheer logic, it's not at all successful. In academic circles, this argument was refuted centuries ago, and again most recently by one of the leading philosophers in the world, Alvin Plantinga, who's the professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame in the US. The conclusion that God does not exist is by no means a logical deduction from the existence of suffering. Let me explain why. The existence of suffering could only be used as evidence against God's existence if you could first prove that an all-loving God does not have good reasons for allowing suffering to continue. In other words, the problem in the equation I just mentioned is point two, an all-loving God would end suffering. But how do we know that? How do we know that an all-loving God definitely would end all the suffering? Until we could show categorically that there is no possible loving purpose behind the continuation of suffering, suffering can't be used as a proof against God. The logical force of the argument completely evaporates. Ironically, a Christian could use exactly the same logic as the atheist to arrive at a completely different conclusion, one that is every bit as reasonable. Here's the Christian three-step equation. 1. God is all-powerful and loving. 2. Suffering exists. 3. God must therefore have loving purposes for suffering, which because of his power, he is able to achieve. Now, please don't misunderstand me. This is not intended as a kind of proof for God. I'm simply trying to show that whether or not you think suffering disproves God's existence depends not on logic, but on your assumptions. If you assume that God couldn't possibly have good, loving reasons for allowing suffering to continue, then you will doubt the existence of God. But if you assume that a loving God must have loving reasons for allowing suffering to continue, then suffering itself won't pose the same intellectual problem. Now, I'm not for a moment suggesting that this settles the problem of suffering. It doesn't even come close. I'm simply pointing out that the presence of suffering in the world presents not so much an intellectual dilemma for our faith. It poses an emotional dilemma. The real question of suffering is not, could God coexist with a world of suffering? But why does God allow it? And just as importantly, what on earth is he going to do about it? These are the more important and more difficult questions, and I'll begin to pursue them in the next few nights. I hope you can join me then.
Hope 103.2. Thanks for listening.